Welcome to the EDUCAUSE 2009 Annual Conference Podcast. The EDUCAUSE 2009 Annual Conference brought together the most influential IT decision makers and resources to improve the ability of higher education to achieve its mission. This podcast is sponsored by Juniper Networks and Quest Communications International. We feature a session by Saeed Chowdhury, Associate Dean for the Library Digital Programs at the Johns Hopkins University, and Clifford Lynch, Executive Director for the Coalition for Networked Information. The session is entitled, Initiatives from the NSF's DataNet Program, Data One and the Data Conservancy.
And before I speak about the Data Conservancy itself, I think it makes sense for me to give you a sense of what we mean when we talk about data curation. This is still a relatively new term, relatively new field. We think of data curation very much as a means and not as an end. Success will not be defined by having data in our archives and being preserved, though that is a necessary condition. The sufficient condition, if you will, would be that it supports science. So it's bringing these different scientific perspectives into the mix that we think is a key aspect of data curation. And in order to do that, we have to have better data management systems and practices and support staff, if you will, that can bring those different data sets together and then build services around those data sets so you can start to explore and ask questions you can't normally do when you have a more siloed type of approach. The Data Conservancy, or DC as we've been calling it, has one overarching goal, which is to support these new forms of inquiry and learning by the creation, implementation, and sustained management of an integrated and comprehensive data curation strategy. One of the interesting aspects of the DataNet program is that it combines both research and implementation. One of the things we'll have to do over the next 5 years and beyond is strike the balance between building out infrastructure in prototype ways, testing it, and then developing it in an iterative cycle as we feed in from the research agenda that we have. NSF has been very clear in saying that this particular program has to result in usable systems. Yes, you should publish papers and you should write and conduct research and so on and mentor students, but at the end of the day, scientists have to be able to go somewhere, use the data in a reliable and persistent manner, and support and advance science. One of the reasons that we talk about this strategy rather than building out the infrastructure immediately is based on some feedback from a report that comes from an NSF workshop in January of 2007. This is a group of individuals that came together at NSF's request to think about infrastructure and how infrastructure has been built from a historical perspective, primarily from the U.S., but also beyond. And one of the really important outcomes, I think, from this workshop was this particular set of phrases that says infrastructure shouldn't be built with a rigid roadmap, but rather principles of navigation. And what they really emphasize in a historical view of infrastructure development efforts is that they primarily start at a smaller system-wide scale. You get local individuals, local groups, communities coming together and having to solve a problem. It's only when the systems from those particular local communities have to start working together that people start to think of a more top-down approach to infrastructure. So living in Baltimore, we think a lot about railroads. And my favorite case, of course, is that we had regional railroad systems in the United States. So particular communities came together and basically said, how do we move goods and people around within our particular geographical view? Once we started to think of a national railroad system, we had to think about how are we going to get these different systems to interoperate. They didn't use that word back then, but in essence, that's what they were thinking of. And that led to a standard railroad gauge so that if you wanted to build toward this national service of the railroad, you had to use that gauge. You could still have your own local network, but it wouldn't play nicely with what was becoming a national infrastructure. Once that happened, not surprisingly, basically all the local variants went away. It just made sense for all of us to work toward this national kind of framework that had been developed. I think that's really important as we think about how to bring together different scientific systems that exist now into a more cohesive kind of infrastructure. So what are some of these principles that we're thinking about when we're talking about the Data Conservancy? As I mentioned, one of them is to look at existing systems. So there are scientific communities. In our case, as Cliff mentioned, at Hopkins, we've been most familiar with astronomy, that have been very successful in building community data standards and data practices and then actually building some service frameworks so that people can come to those systems, access data, and run their analyses against them. They've even pushed this out beyond the professional astronomy community into the public at large. One example of one of these frameworks is called the Sky Server. There are apparently about 10,000 professional astronomers in the world, And SkyServer has over 900,000 registered users. So this is clearly something that is being used outside of the professional astronomy community. So we have these success stories. We certainly want to learn from them and build on them. But how do we take those success stories, understand, in some sense, what led to their success, and analyze what maybe could have been done in a more productive manner, and then apply that out to other scientific disciplines and other scientific domains? There are other communities that are grappling with these same kinds of issues, others that may have made progress in different ways. So it'll be very important for us to weave together the lessons that we have from all these different scientific communities and try and think about how we work with their systems in a generalizable way, not a specific one-off kind of way. We intend to do that through a user-centered design methodology in the earlier years, basically helping us come up with some of the more scientific requirements at an early stage. And then over time, we would think about an information science research agenda informing the data curation practices across these different disciplines. I'll give you a little bit more information about that in some subsequent slides. And of course, all of this has to be sustained in a very systematic way. One of the important characteristics of the DataNet program is, as Cliff mentioned, in this first five-year phase, there will be five awards. Our understanding is that at the end of that, in year six, if you want to think about that, only one of these teams will receive additional funding from NSF. And even that is supposed to be waning or diminishing over time. For those of you familiar with NSF proposals, you know they typically emphasize the intellectual merit and the broader impacts of the proposals. This proposal was different in the sense that it also had a sustainability element, which is supposed to be equally important. So we have to think about how not only to build this infrastructure, but how to sustain it. Some of the partner institutions that we have, these are the institutions that are directly supported through the NSF award itself. It is led by the library at Johns Hopkins. But we have a group of other institutions. Some of them are familiar in terms of being universities. Some of them are community organizations that have grown out of the digital library community, DuraSpace being one. Some of you may remember that as Fedora Commons and the DSpace Foundation, which have come together now into this organization known as DuraSpace. Portico is also one of those kinds of organizations that I think has grown out of, in some sense, the digital library community. Tesella Incorporated is a consulting group. This is a group of people that have worked with the Electronic Records Archive Project at NARA and some digital preservation activities in Europe. And I like to think what they bring is some industrial strength, software development, and project management to the mix, which I think will be absolutely critical as we move forward with the Data Conservancy. This is a list of what I call the additional partners, because they're not explicitly identified in the budget line of the proposal. But that's not intended to be a value statement of any sort. A lot of the things that some of these partners are proposing to do are really critical and an integral part of what we're hoping to accomplish. Just a couple of examples I can give you. The Australian National Data Service has already developed a collection registry. So a key part of what we're hoping to do, of course, is find what other people have done and see if they can fit into the infrastructure that we're building, rather than trying to invent everything on our own. Another example I'll give you is the Sakai Foundation. So we've been working with the Sakai Foundation to think about how Sakai might integrate with the work we're doing in the Data Conservancy. The idea would be that as scientific data moves into our archives, we would build the kind of connection you would need so that you could discover it seamlessly in Sakai. You would basically log into your Sakai course or your collaboration framework, and there would be an opportunity for you to discover the kind of data that are being archived within the Data Conservancy. For obvious reasons, this would be very useful in the sense that many institutions are using Sakai, more generally speaking, using these course management systems. So building connections between those two would be very important. The only reason I've got Sun Microsystems in blue is because it's the most recent development. Basically, they have chosen us to be a data curation center of excellence. That's something that actually we haven't officially signed, but we've agreed on the parameters for this center of excellence, and we're launching forward with them. The way that the Data Conservancy has organized its work is around the overarching goal I described earlier, but through these four objectives. They are infrastructure research and development, information science and computer science research, broader impacts, and sustainability. And what you see below each of those working teams' titles is what I think of as the different categories of requirements that each of them are looking at. So I work in the Digital Libraries Group at Hopkins. I tend to think of technical requirements first and probably foremost. But in this particular program, we have to think of the scientific requirements, of course. So we're looking to our information scientists and our computer scientists to help inform what might be the kinds of requirements scientists have when they use their data, when they analyze their data. The broader impacts I'm broadly thinking of is the educational outreach requirements. How do we train the next generation of information science or library science professionals to support this kind of activity? One of the things that we're finding, and this is true across both Data Conservancy and Data One, is lack of what we're calling data scientists. These are individuals who have a very deep disciplinary or domain knowledge, yet also understand the information management or data management practices. What's happening now is scientific teams are basically taking one of their own and saying, you know, you're taking one for the team. You're going to be our data manager, and you're not going to do a lot of research in astronomy or geology or whatever the case may be. Now, you can understand that in some cases, people don't necessarily want this to be their career path. So these scientific teams are very much looking to a capacity-building effort so that they can hire data scientists who are dedicated for this kind of work. It's really important to know two elements involved here. One is trust. Partially the reason they're choosing one of their own is they trust those individuals. So one of the ways in which I think libraries can benefit from the trust we already have with our faculty is to leverage that and say, okay, we want to become a trusted partner in the data management aspects as well. And the other is that this has profound implications for, I think, how libraries train and basically reward the librarians or the data scientists, if you will, that we have in place. Right now, this type of work is not recognized, at least I think broadly speaking, not recognized as a rewarded path for librarians. And I think that needs to change. We do have some cases where that's happening. And the sustainability team, if you will, is looking at the business requirements. So one of the things we don't do in digital libraries, certainly, is think about sustainability from the inception or the onset of something. Typically, we waited till about a year or two before the grant funding ends or the university's telling us, how are you going to sustain this? I think that's a mistake. We're taking sustainability or the business requirements as equal to the other class of requirements that you see on the slide, and we're thinking about them from day one. The sustainability team has a fairly unusual mix of individuals. So while I'm leading it, I'm joined by one of my colleagues at Hopkins in the libraries who has an MBA, and she's worked in the private sector before. Brings a very different perspective to the conversation than I typically have. We're joined by a professional society. The Optical Society of America is coming to the mix because they care about data management, yet they're not sure what business model will work for them. We're also joined by a venture capital group. A group called Zoom Intelligence approached the Dean of Engineering at Hopkins and said, we're very interested in trying to build services, fee-based services, around data. And he said, you should go talk to the people in the library who are working on this. I don't know if you've ever dealt with venture capital people before. They don't think the way I do, and I don't think the way they do. I'm not trying to imply one is better than the other. But there were several occasions when we were developing the proposal and the accompanying documentation where basically they would say, well, that's nice, Saeed, but that's really the way you think about it in higher education or academia. That's not a business-like way of thinking about this. So I think getting those perspectives into the mix is going to be really critical. I'm going to work through each of those four objectives or what the teams associated with those objectives are thinking about right now and where we'd like to see ourselves in about 5 years. Of course, if you're thinking about an infrastructure development effort, you have to have a technical architecture. And this is an initial technical architecture. This is not the end of the story, it's the beginning. But given the experience we've had over the years, given the engagement we've had with our partners and throughout the community, we have some initial ideas about how we think this architecture needs to work. Certainly, we have some initial ideas about what we think it has to be able to do. And modularity is a critical piece of this. Going back to that, not having a rigid roadmap, if we build a very rigid architecture right now, it will break. As we learn more about the different classes of requirements, the different kinds of data, the different kinds of uses, I'm absolutely sure what would happen is we would basically try and stretch this thing that is rigid until it just breaks apart. So we have to have a flexibility in how the architecture supports the infrastructure development effort. One of the key aspects of the Data Conservancy is to bring data into our environment. So the library at Johns Hopkins has made a commitment basically to step forward and take data and bring it into our archives. And I think this is something libraries need to do much more. And this is a very daunting prospect. So we've signed a memorandum of understanding with the Astrophysical Research Consortium, who has stewardship for the Sloan Digital Sky Survey data. This is one of the large digital astronomy projects that's taken place over the last 15 years. When we negotiated with them about what it means to actually bring the data and What software do we care about? What algorithms do we care about? Do we maintain your databases or keep them in flat files? These are all fundamental questions. We finally figured out how much data that we're talking about. It's 140 terabytes. So I asked one of my colleagues in the central IT group at Hopkins, how much data do you think the central IT organization is dealing with right now? And he said 60 terabytes. So in one fell swoop, one science project has come along and doubled, tripled, however you want to think about it, the size of the data that we're thinking about. So I'm not naive. I believe that this has its own set of challenges. So I don't think every library needs to do this. But I do think some of the research library community needs to step forward and say, give us your data. We will take it, bring it in locally, and we will figure out what it means to preserve these data sets. Now, having said that, we also recognize data will be everywhere. It's not going to be all at Hopkins. It's not going to be all at Cornell or any of our partners, or even within the entire DataNet partnership. So we have to build the architecture to be able to interface with data that's being stored in other places. One of the most exciting developments we have, even at this early stage, is thinking about the cloud. So one of our partners, DuraSpace, has a service that's being developed called DuraCloud. And one of our early one-year deliverables, if you will, is to think about how our architecture will fit with data that may be stored in the cloud. From the information science or computer science perspective, one of the most important components of what we're thinking about is what we're calling the data framework. What I really mean by this is, how do you as a scientist, or even as an amateur, discover data across different scientific disciplines, yet do so in a way that allows you to continue drilling deep? So whenever we think of these overarching kinds of data frameworks, or if you want to think about ontologies or these semantic web kinds of technologies, the big concern that I have is it becomes so simplistic that, yes, you can discover there are different types of data sets, but then you can't do anything beyond that. So if I'm an expert in meteorological data, and I listen to Dr. Washington tell me that population growth is important, I may decide, okay, I need to go figure out what population data exists in a format that I can use. But then I might go to a population researcher and say, well, so what are the queries you run against these data sets? How do I run those queries against the kinds of analyses that I typically run? How do we merge the climate data and the social science data together? So if the data framework doesn't allow that kind of richness of exploration or depth, then we've really, in some sense, compromised the ability to go deep. The key aspect of this is a common conceptualization, and what we've thought about is this concept of observation. So as we were developing the proposal, now, we kept thinking about what is some concept that you might span, that spans across lots of different scientific disciplines. And we thought the observation is a key aspect of this. And observations do have data elements or data characteristics. There's time, there's location, there's those types of things. And those are very simple elements, of course, and pretty much all sciences would agree that there's time and location. But what are some other kinds of elements of observation that might span across different disciplines? And again, we're looking to astronomy, which has developed a data model for observation, and we're looking to other disciplines that have also developed these kinds of data models and trying to find common elements, trying to find a way of meshing them together into an overarching framework. One of the protocols that we think is very promising in this regard is the Open Archives Initiative Object Reuse and Exchange, OAIORE for short. If you're not familiar with it, fundamentally what ORE is trying to do is think about compound objects. So rather than a publication being the only form of scientific output, how is that publication connected to other publications, to data sets that are cited within those publications? And how, in turn, are those data sets connected to even deeper levels of data, all the way back to the instruments that generated the data sets themselves? For those of you who are familiar with archives or archival science, we're really talking about provenance. Who touched the data, and what do you do with it? It's not just the machines, it's the people as well. What decisions went into using that particular algorithm or that particular calibration technique? Was the instrument working properly on that day and at that time? These are critical things for us to capture as we think about the preservation. It's also critical in terms of validity. It's one thing for Saeed Chaudhry to have an astronomy data set. It's another for the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. I'm assuming you'll trust Sloan a lot more than you'll trust me. So getting that kind of information into the chain will be critical as well. I'd mentioned this idea of thinking about astronomy as an exemplar community and then building out and reaching out to other types of communities. So we're thinking of four areas for our initial scientific domains. One being astronomy, for some of the reasons that I just described. and the others being biodiversity, earth sciences, and social sciences. Now, those are huge domains. You can think of lots of different kinds of data. What we're doing to encapsulate, if you will, or scope the problem is developing use cases. And the idea would be that we would go to the scientist directly and say, what type of data do you use, and what do you do with them? Literally, just start at that level and ask them to give us a story. And we've already gotten three of these from the scientists within our network. And we can use those to sift through and figure out what types of data are important and what types of services, associated services, are important for them as well. A very real-world example, we have an earth sciences use case that was developed by the National Snow and Ice Data Center. We have a geologist at Hopkins who's been going to Antarctica every other year and looking at what are called the dry valleys. Now, he's been gathering data for his research, which is geology. He goes and he looks at the rock samples and so on. The National Snow and Ice Data Center is interested in, as you can imagine, snow and ice. So the use case basically helped us look at the dry valleys data in a different way. We asked one of our data scientists to read the use case, to go through the dry valleys data, and identify the data that would support that NSIDC use case. And no surprise, these were not the data that the Hopkins geologist would have thought of initially. So these use cases are allowing us to have a different lens that brings some sort of organizing principles, if you will, into the mix. The fourth and final team or objective that I described is sustainability. This is, as I mentioned, we're thinking of the business requirements as being equal amongst the others. And some things maybe you would think of and they're familiar. A portfolio approach, trying to get different kinds of funding sources. Aligning with existing institutional priorities. Those things make perfect sense. Leveraging our partner sustainability mechanisms. So we have, for example, the Sakai Foundation or DuraSpace, others who are thinking about sustainability on their own. Recently, I got an email from someone asking about building a security enhancement to the Fedora repository software system. And we looked at it and we thought, this is important. This could be useful for the Data Conservancy. They were asking for $5,000 contributions from particular institutions to do this. And we said, sure, we're happy to do that. Because if we didn't, we'd have to do it on our own. So there's an opportunity for us, in some sense, to leverage the sustainability plans that other organizations are putting out there. Economies of scale and economies of scope that I'm talking about. So when we were talking with the Sloan Digital Sky Survey folks, we said, you have 140 terabytes, we're going to have three copies. That's much more storage than we have right now. So we're going to go out and buy a storage system to deal with this. Well, it turns out that the storage system comes in either 500 terabyte or 1 petabyte chunks. You can't buy 420 terabytes of it. So we said, you know, it'd be really great if we could buy a petabyte. I know we only need the 500, but if we can go to the 1 petabyte, we can not only deal with other data that you come to us with, we can deal with other data from other projects. And to their credit, they said, sure, go right ahead. That's fine with us. We've also signed an MOU with the Walters Art Museum in Baltimore to start curating the data from one of their digital projects. They've taken their Islamic manuscript collection and digitized those manuscripts. And they don't have the expertise and they don't have the inclination, quite frankly, to build data curation infrastructure on their own. So they contacted us, said, we hear you're doing this work. It's not science, but it's still data. So we'd love for you to take this responsibility off our hands. And we did. So at the end of the day, ones and zeros are ones and zeros. You can put the same stuff, the manuscript data, on the same storage system as the astronomy data. So these economies of scope, I think, are equally important as well. And Cliff and I are both members of a task force that's looking at sustainable digital preservation and access. And by the end of this calendar year, we will issue our second report, which will have a set of recommendations for not only individual institutions, but the community in terms of what to do for preserving digital content in a sustainable way. We certainly intend to factor all of those in to our sustainability plans. It is a real shame Bill Mishner could not be here because the Data One project is really an amazing initiative and Bill does a great job talking about it. I think both Cliff and I really felt like we couldn't do it justice. There are several ways in which we're already thinking about working with Data One. Climate change is one area we're both concerned about. Broadly speaking, I think the Data One folks are thinking about this from the ecological perspective, whereas we're thinking about it more from the social science perspective. So same grand challenge research problem, but complementary views. We're also sharing notes on the technical architecture. And we want to make sure that whatever they're doing works with whatever we're doing. And there are other working group activities that have already started as place. The information science personnel from both groups are already talking about the data framework that we're putting forward and the ontologies that they're trying to develop in terms of mapping between different kinds of data sets they look at. The sustainability, I've been talking about it from the perspective of the Data Conservancy, but I'd like to think that when all five data net partners are up and running, we think about it in a holistic kind of way. Now, I know this is a very complex set of moving parts and organizations, but how do we sustain the entire program rather than sustain each of our particular awards? And then finally, of course, we think it's really important to work together for the education and outreach activities. They have very sophisticated ways in which they're thinking about this, and I'd like to believe we have the same. So why not have both Data One and Data Conservancy at some of these kinds of workshops, some of these kinds of data curation boot camps, as we're calling them, and get both of those perspectives together into the mix. I'd like to end by a few notes about libraries, because I think this is a really important point. I think the sustainability argument we made is that we need to start getting libraries involved in this kind of work, and consequently getting library resources, systems, people, dollars, you name it, into the mix to do this kind of data curation work. But I think what it will require of us to do is think of libraries as part of the distributed network. No institutional repository is going to take 140 terabytes of astronomy data for scale reasons, and the fact is it's not an institutional data set. But your institutional repository may be a node on that network. There are data, even Excel spreadsheets, that your scientists are creating that are connected to other data sets, that are connected to publications. I'm really trying to encourage libraries to think of gathering those unique data sources, no matter how big they may be or how small they may be, and think about how they connect to this bigger data network. I also think of the data curation activities in the Data Conservancy as a collection development effort. So yes, we are looking at use cases, and yes, we are looking at services. But fundamentally, doesn't it make sense for libraries to think of these collections that we bring into our environments, just as we bought physical collections in, sometimes not even knowing what the potential uses could be? I think there's going to be some value in having large amounts of data aggregated in places, because it's really hard to move those data across the network, quite frankly. So you can push your analyses to these large data stores, but the folks who have the data locally, I think, will be able to do even more. Data as services is a reinforcing theme throughout all of this. Ultimately, what I'd love to see is when you put data into the Data Conservancy, not only do you discover it, you immediately recognize what kinds of services can be run against that, and what kinds of services from other communities may be able to run against those data. I had talked about the important human element of this. There's a fundamental portion of infrastructure, of course, is people. And if we don't try to think about what the next generation of librarianship is, then I think we run the risk of becoming irrelevant, quite frankly. I just want to end with this quote, because I've talked a lot about the support we're getting from Johns Hopkins and the library there. I think this is a great quote from the Dean of Libraries at Hopkins. Data centers are the new library stacks. I couldn't have said it better myself.
This EDUCAUSE 2009 Annual Conference Podcast is sponsored by Juniper Networks and Quest Communications International. Thanks for listening.